The following podcast contains adult subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
Hello, listeners. Welcome to this special interview episode of Thinking Outside the Long Box. Today on the line, I have Lawrence McNaughton. He is the author of the Drew Jasper series, which just had a new novel come out, Forever in a Doomsday, on October 15th. This is urban dark fantasy, all set within our backyard, Denver. I know not all of our listeners are from Colorado, but many of you are. So welcome to the show, Lawrence. How are you today?
Doing great. Thanks for having me here.
So when I think of like kind of magical cities, Denver is not one of the cities that jumps to mind. You know, I usually would think of like Salem or like New Orleans or something to that effect. How do you work magic into Denver? Because I just got to know.
Well, that's a good question. See, what I when I sat down to write this series, it actually started out as a short story rather than a book, and I was just writing a short story about a magic shop set in Denver, just, you know, because I live here. And it was kind of a quirky, funny story with a little bit of spooks and scares and that sort of thing, but mostly, you know, it's just lighthearted adventure. And as I was working on this story and developing it, and I brought it to my writing group, and they kept saying, oh, well, what about this, and what about that, and what about this other character, and I kept growing it. I decided to keep it in Denver, and it was kind of fun because all of a sudden I could have monsters, I could have magic, I could have car chases through Denver, and that was something I had never seen before, and it's just a lot of fun to do.
Tell me a little bit just about the basics of the book, you know, for listeners that haven't read one of the novels, you know, just give us the groundwork of what we're looking at. Cause I know it is several books long at this point.
It is. Yeah. It's funny cause it started out as just a short story. In fact, on my website at lawrencemcnaughton.com, you can get the chronologically, the very first Drew Jasper story. It's called Magic Carpet Ride. And you can get that for free just for signing up. But basically what the story is, though, the whole series is about this woman, Drew Jasper, who has a little crystal shop in Denver where she sells crystals and potions and stuff like that to these sorcerers who, you know, protect the world against eternal darkness. And at the start of the series, she only has a little bit of magical potential. She's not really a full-fledged sorceress, and she always is looking at this like she's on the outskirts of that world. And see, in the original, when I originally started working on this, she was just a minor character. And everybody just kept saying, oh, I love Drew. She's such a great character. You should write a story about her. Forget these other guys. And so it became her journey from being sort of the supporting backstage sort of person to actually being put into position where only she can save the world, and she doesn't feel up to it at all. So, you know, suddenly she's dealing with monsters, she's dealing with a demon possessed muscle car, she has friends and enemies who can, you know, transform into rock or you know, levitate things with their minds, and she's up against, in the first book, she's up against the four horsemen of the apocalypse, and it only gets more difficult from there, if you can believe it. So every book, there's some sort of doomsday threat, and she's the only one who can stop it. So it sounds like it's dark, but it's actually, I forget who it was, one of the big reviewers, I forget if it was Publishers Weekly or Library Journal or somebody, they called it a demon-fueled romantic comedy. And I thought, that's actually kind of that's not a bad description of it.
You know, that space for, you know, supernatural plus like humor and plus romance, it seems to be growing. You know, even television shows like Supernatural have entire, you know, episodes that are tongue in cheek, and, you know, Ash versus the Evil Dead, and then of course the original Evil Dead movies, and that space for scary plus funny is growing. Do you feel like it's just a really fun way to work? You know, you're almost entertaining yourself as you write.
I do. I actually crack myself up sometimes. And, you know, and I love all those shows that you just mentioned. And I think the reason that I like to write these kinds of stories is that personally, you know, I enjoy a dark, scary movie or you know, so just as much as the next person. But when I'm writing a book, yeah, I would just want something that at the end of it, it's going to make me want to stand up and cheer. You know, I want something that's really kind of empowering. I want something with, you know, a lot of back and forth, crackerjack dialogue. I want, you know, funny gags. At the same time, you know, I want a story that's really meaningful. In fact, when I speak at writing conferences and people ask me, how do you write a book that is gripping but at the same time funny? And I say, here's what you do. And this is a trade secret right here. You write it as a drama first, and then you go back in and add the funny stuff. So when I sit down and write it, I don't think of a funny situation. I think of, you know, Drew is up against some sort of soul-sucking demon of darkness that's going to destroy the world. And I make that work as a story. And then I go back in and I give her funnier dialogue and I give her friends some gags. And, you know, I do all these things to contrast all this darkness with a lot of excitement and a lot of humor. So it's something where I'm not deliberately saying, you know, here, let's make this funny. It just kind of happens naturally. I try not to take it too seriously, if that makes sense.
It does. It's an interesting way to like develop a hook for your reader and then put the funny in on kind of the back end. That's actually a very fascinating process.
Yeah.
When I was reading kind of your biography, I read in there that you were a prototype vehicle test driver, and I'm not even really sure what that means.
So that was a fun job. So what I used to do, and unfortunately I can't talk about too many details because of all these non-disclosure agreements, but what I used to do is take prototype vehicles where the technology was, you know, several years in advance of what's on the road, and the manufacturers, you know, would provide these test vehicles to basically see if we could break them, you know. So, for example, and it would be something, you know, like we've got a prototype transmission. We've got a prototype transfer case for a four-wheel drive vehicle, things like that. And so I would take these vehicles up into the mountains because here in Colorado we did high-altitude testing. I would take it up into the mountains. I would take it up into the snow and basically – you know, it looked like a Jeep commercial where, you know, I'm trying to do all this extreme stuff to try and break it. Because the point was, if I can destroy something that's a prototype during what we would expect to be, you know, the outer limits of what an actual driver would do, then they need to fix that and they need to go back and build something that will last, something that's stronger, better, faster, whatever it is. So we had these test sites all over the country. There was one down on the Gulf Coast that would do saltwater testing. There was one out in Nevada that would do extreme heat testing. And basically, you know, my job, and I had to track 30 different vehicles at a time, every single thing that was wrong with each one of these vehicles. It was an enormous amount of data. And basically, you know, take it out into the wild and see if I could break it. And sometimes I did. So that was an interesting job. And whenever I sit down to write a book, I love to put in car stuff, not just necessarily car chases and over the top stunts, although I do a lot of those, but also, you know, just interesting little tidbits. Like one of the most popular characters in this series, which surprised me, is a car called Hellbringer. And it's a demon possessed 1969 Dodge Charger Daytona, which is possibly the most evil-looking car ever built. And it's black. And in the first book, it belongs to one of the four horsemen of the apocalypse. And so it's sort of like a muscle car version of Stephen King's Christine. So I get to do all these crazy car chases and jumps and crashing through stuff. And, of course, the car can fix itself like Christine can. And so big question. In the first book, the car is literally evil. I mean, it actually tries to kill the characters. And I got so much fan response that I said, I have to bring this car back. And so I had actually already started writing book two without that car necessarily in it. And it was just amazing. I said, because this, you know, quote-unquote character, it can't talk. There's no dialogue with Hellbringer. It's just an evil car, and yet everybody loves it. So it was really interesting to get that sort of feedback from the fans and say, you know, I love writing this car too. Let's bring it back. And now it has this huge story arc that goes all the way through. And in the fourth book that just came out, the car literally has to go back into the hell that it came from in order to save the world. And the question becomes, is it going to stay evil? Is it going to try and destroy the world? Or is it going to help, you know, these puny humans that have been, you know, driving around in it for the last four books? So, you know, it's just crazy that something starts out so random and just keeps going based on feedback and good ideas just rolling out.
So it's interesting to me how responsive you are to your fans' feedback. I don't know a ton of authors that are like that. I think Scott Sigler is very responsive to like fan feedback, especially when he was writing The Rookie and putting it out as a podcast and things like that. What is it about, you know, the interaction with fans that really drives you to like mold some of the ideas and characters in your books around their responses?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. I've never really thought about it before. I will tell you that when I was a kid, my parents had a game store, and so I grew up playing a lot of games. I mean, I started playing D&D when I was like, you know, 9. So I guess to me, writing a book is just sort of an extension of that, where I feel like when I'm writing a book, I feel like I'm sharing it with my friends, and I want to hear what they say. And even if these are people who are literally not even in, you know, in the same part of the country, or even in the same country I am, you know, people will get back to me. I had a lady in England who just absolutely went crazy over It Happened One Doomsday. And she was asking me all these questions. And I thought, you know, this is great. You know, you can have a conversation about this and I can talk about these ideas. You know, speaking of the first book, It Happened One Doomsday, when I finished writing it, the very day I finished writing it, I called my wife up and I said, I just finished writing the book. You're never going to guess what happens. And she says, she thinks about it for a second, she says, well, I bet this happens, and then that happens, and then this other thing happens. And I thought, wow, that is actually way better than what I just came up with. So I went back and changed the ending. And some people, just when I brought it to my writers group, they freaked out. And I thought, okay, good, I think I got a good ending there. And that's something that I talk about when I talk at writing conferences, is you don't necessarily have all of your best ideas right up front when you sit down and write a book. You know, sometimes better ideas come along and you have to make a choice. Am I going to stick with what I thought originally, or am I going to look at this other idea and maybe take this in an unexpected direction and go explore, you know, this new story idea? And to me, that is one of the most fun things about being a writer, is being able to take new ideas and infuse them into what I'm already working on. And I guess that's one reason why I am so keen on hearing what people say and engaging in a dialogue about it.
Talking about like growing up in a gaming store, and I had also read in your biography that you used to work with like antiquarian books. Mm-hmm. Is that lifelong like love of reading and like proximity to books, do you think that's one of the things that pushed you into becoming a writer?
Oh, definitely. In fact, when I was a little kid, I found an old antique Remington portable typewriter, you know, the kind with the black keys and the, you know, tap, 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 ding, you know, that sort of thing. And so I just immediately started typing on it. And so I went to my parents, I went to my teachers, and I said, you know, I'm going to be a writer. And they all looked at me very carefully and said, well, you know, nobody makes a living as a writer, so how about plan B? I'm like 10 years old at this point. But when I was in college, in my very, actually, technically, it was right before I got into college. I actually met an African storyteller. Now, this is a true story. This guy was a professor at the local university, and he's this little tiny guy who was from Africa. And when he spoke like six languages. And when he wasn't teaching at the university, teaching literature, he would actually travel around the world collecting oral stories and writing them down to preserve them before they disappeared. And I was just absolutely fascinated by that. And I guess that was a formative moment for me because I realized there's so many different kinds of storytelling in this world. And so I ended up selling my first magazine article at age 19, and I've been a writer ever since.
Wow, that's really cool. Like, what a fascinating like life that guy probably has had, just traveling the world and collecting. I mean, that sounds incredible. Sorry. That's new life goals, I guess, for me.
It was just the most fascinating idea that there's all of these little groups of people. Yeah, you know, you just pick any country, and there's going to be a bunch of different areas where people have different stories. In fact, the original Grimm's fairy tales in Europe were collected from different areas of Germany. It was originally a scientific project where they were trying to preserve the sort of, you know, the oral storytelling of bedtime stories. And of course, it grew into what is today, you know, Grimm's fairy tales with all the different editions and all the inspirations that have come from that. But it's the same type of idea where people have been telling stories for, you know, sometimes hundreds of years and stories that we are not familiar with. And it's just so fascinating to me that it's such a universal human experience that there's such a wide diversity of stories out there.
So when you know, as you're continuing through the series, you're having to come up with new, you know, forces for your protagonist to encounter. Like, what kind of wells do you draw from? Like, what are you looking to for your research and for your inspirations?
Oh, man, I literally have a folder stuffed full of stuff that I've for every idea that I put in one of the Drew Jasper books, I've got 10 ideas that just aren't going to make it. There's just so much out there. Me personally, I'm inspired by looking back at, you know, bizarre historical artifacts, weird. Like, for example, all of the books in the Drew Jasper series, she has these books with just these strange titles, and they're all based on actual titles of actual books. When I used to work at an antiquarian bookstore, we had cardboard boxes full of old medieval manuscripts, handwritten in Latin. And I thought, gosh, these must be priceless. And the guy who owned the shop said, no, not really. You want one? What? Really? Because nobody knew what they were. Nobody could take the time to translate them. Nobody really cared. And it was just such a bizarre concept to me that here's something that somebody handwrote, you know, centuries ago, maybe even 1,000 years ago. And, you know, it's written on, you know, paper thin parchment, you know, actual cured goat skin or something. And it's written by hand with a quill pen, and the ink has faded so that you can barely read it. And it's in Latin and some other things, and there's weird drawings in it. It's like, really, nobody wants this? And just, that bizarre inspiration, for example, became all of the weird books in the series. So, you know, as we go through life, we're constantly surrounded by just the strangest things. Crystals, for example. The main character in my book uses crystals for, that's where she gets her magic powers. And I read somewhere that back in the ancient Egyptian times, you know, the Egyptians came up with the whole idea of, you know, eyeliner. And it wasn't just for looks. They believed that if they painted those dark lines around their eyes, that it would protect them from the evil eye. Well, here's the thing. Scientists have discovered that, well, let me back up. What they would use to create that makeup was ground up galena crystals. Galena is a lead sulfide. Well, lead sulfide kills bacteria. So if you paint it around your eyes, and an insect landed on your eyelid that would normally transmit a bacteria to your eye and cause an eye infection, that bacteria might be killed by the ground-up eye makeup that you're wearing. So in a very real way, in a very scientific way, it really did protect them from the evil eye. And I thought, oh my God, how fascinating is that? So what if I took all these real-life scientific properties and then just elevated them up to a superpowered level, and I have a character who can, for example, use Galena to not just fight against the evil eye, but to actually fight demons? You know, and so that's sort of where that came from. So I started researching into crystals, and when I started, I thought, how many crystals are there? Like 10, 12? You know, I thought, well, there's quartz, there's amethyst, and maybe some others. There are thousands of crystals in this world. They're still discovering new kinds of crystals. And so for me, it was a lot of fun to go in and do the research into what people have believed for thousands of years. For example, that there's a crystal called sunstone. And people used to believe that exposure to sunstone would cure lunacy, which obviously doesn't really work. But in my book, I was able to turn sunstone into something that she can use to create sunlight to drive off undead. You know, things like that, you just take an idea and you run with it until it becomes exciting and interesting, and then you can put it in a story.
That's really cool, like the, you know, talking about the Galena and it being able to fight off bacteria. I just talked to two, I guess, like magical practitioners last week, because we were going to do a seance episode, and talk to some people that are doing something called the Conjure Gala this November. And they were talking about how these ancient traditions and folk medicines, you know, that people think of as magic, people continue to use them because they do have practical results. Maybe we don't understand how it works, but it works. And that's kind of the same thing with the eyeliner. It's just interesting how it's kind of a full circle thing. And then you have, you know, zoomed off with it into fiction as well. It's really cool.
I just want to go on the record as saying that I'm not recommending that anybody but put lead sulfide on their eyes. Not a great idea, but yeah. But yeah, it's fascinating. And in fact, when I do book signings and events, I will frequently bring crystals just to show people, because, you know, you can't go into a mountain town in Colorado without finding a rock shop somewhere.
Right. Estes has
probably
20.
There are so many cool rocks. Yeah. Yeah, it's very cool.
As we're kind of wrapping up, you know, you have a new novel out in the Drew Jasper series. How can people find you and find the novel to check out this, what sounds like an amazing series of books?
No, thank you. So you can always go to my website. That's lawrencemacnaughton.com. It's LaurenceMacNaughton.com. And by the way, when I wrote my first book, I told my agent, yeah, I'd really like to use a pen name that's shorter. And she said, no, Lawrence MacNaughton is a very authorly name. I'm like, really? Okay. So that's my real name. But yeah, go to lawrencemacnaughton.com. I've got all the information about the books. I've got pictures of the characters on there. I've got little, you know, plot summaries and stuff so you can get caught up. And then I say, go support your local bookstore. The book is available. It's distributed through, I think it's Simon & Schuster now. And so all of your local bookstores can get it. You can, if they don't have it in store, ask them to order it in for you. And that way you're supporting a local business too.
That's awesome. Well, thank you, Lawrence, so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having
me. You know, I got kind of short notice for the interview, so I haven't had an opportunity to read the book yet, but I plan on it because it sounds right up my alley. I love this kind of stuff. So,
well, that's awesome. And like I said, I also have the free short story on my website, Magic Carpet Rides. So just go to my website, and it's just sort of an introduction to Drew's world. One of her friends ends up getting a magic carpet that goes haywire, and Drew has to chase her down and rescue her. It's fun. So yeah, come check it out.
It sounds awesome, and I can't wait to read about a more magical Denver.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Thinking Outside the Long Box podcast. Join us on Facebook and Twitter to get behind-the-scenes information for exclusive content and to be notified when new episodes are available. The thoughts and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the individual and do not necessarily represent or reflect those of the Thinking Outside the Long Box podcast, Barron Space Productions, its partners, or affiliates. The Thinking Outside the Long Box podcast is made available by its creators, Juan, John, and Gabe. The podcast is edited and produced by Juan, and Albie is the co-executive producer. The Thinking Outside the Long Box podcast is a Barron Space production.